Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. It's called fracking, which is shorthand for high-volume hydraulic fracturing, and it's the latest technology used to extract oil and natural gas trapped deep inside the earth. Like sauerkraut or liver, it's hard to find anyone neutral on the topic. The petroleum industry sees this process as a means of extracting hard-to-get-at oil and natural gas worth billions of dollars. Opponents see it as a dangerous practice and a threat to human health and the environment. Some states and local governments are moving to regulate the practice, and this hour we're going to take a closer look at it. My guest is Nicholas Kuznets, who is a freelance journalist covering hydraulic fracturing for ProPublica. He's also a multimedia journalist based in New York and has written and reported on natural resources, public policy, food, and other issues for The Nation, Miller McCune, The New York Times, KQED Radio, and other publications. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by asking the most obvious question. What exactly is fracking?
Fracking is a practice where after you drill the well, you blast little holes down at the bottom of an oil or gas well and then shoot water, sand, and chemicals at high pressure. And then that practice sort of cracks the rock and allows the gas or sometimes oil that's in this kind of tight rock to flow freely out of it and into the well.
So how are the holes blasted?
Drillers will put small explosives, essentially, and they puncture little holes in the side of the well. And then the fluids are able to go through those holes, and the sand that's suspended in the fluid holds open the cracks. And then, you know, the rock is sort of naturally fractured, and so drillers design these fractures to intersect with those and kind of open up a web of cracks that allows everything to flow through.
I guess most of us who aren't petroleum geologists think about oil and gas as existing in large pockets or pools under the earth, and that all that's necessary is that we poke our way into one of these and allow the oil or the gas to come up to the surface. This technique would seem to have a different aim, and I would it's used what primarily where the petroleum product is trapped in shale.
Well, that's what a lot of the big growth over the last few years, the last decade, has been. But as you said, sort of more traditional oil and gas drilling, you drill into more porous rock where it's almost like a sponge, and once you put the well in there, the oil or gas can flow into the well. But with shale, it's much less porous rock. There's other kinds of rock that are similar, but most of the drilling lately has been in shale. And so just by drilling in alone, it doesn't, you know, the gas and oil won't flow as freely.
Where is this process being used in the United States right now?
It's being used all over. Some of the biggest areas are there are parts of Texas where it's being used, Pennsylvania, where there's been a lot of controversy and coverage. There's a large shale gas formation under that state and a number of surrounding states, but also in Arkansas, in Colorado, New Mexico, North Dakota, really in pretty much anywhere that oil and gas drilling is being done.
How long has this technique been used? When was it invented?
Well, the practice itself has been around for quite a while. It was first used in the late 1940s, but the drilling industry will often say this to sort of cite how safe it is and how long it's been around. But what's happened over the last 5 or 10 years is something entirely different, where this practice of, you know, pressurized injection was combined with horizontal drilling, another practice that's been around for a while, where you drill down to the rock that you're targeting, and then the drill bit makes a bend and sort of drills along the formation to expose more of the rock. And so the combination of these two practices together with using much greater volumes. I mean, most of these wells are drilled with injected with millions and millions of gallons of water and sand and chemicals. And so this sort of high-volume practice that's getting so much attention really began sort of middle to the second half of the last decade.
Okay. Why is this process so popular right now? What's behind it? What do proponents really like about fracking?
Well, as you said, it's sort of freed up enormous deposits of oil and gas that previously it hadn't been economical to exploit. So there are giant oil and gas fields that are now accessible. And the wells, while they cost a lot to drill, are also highly productive. In the last decade, really the use of this practice was the primary driver in making gas so cheap. It's, you know, gas prices are really low now, and that's all because of the success of this practice.
Well, it needs to be said that our appetite for hydrocarbons continues unabated in this country and around the world. In fact, demand seems to be increasing. It seems like we ought to expect to see more of this rather than less because, well, the people seem to want the product. But the people who oppose this think it's bad. Why is that? What do they not like about this process?
Well, there are a whole host of problems associated with this. You know, a lot of people have been concerned about groundwater. I mentioned the chemicals involved. It's sort of each company and each well can have a different mix of chemicals, but there are hundreds of chemicals that can be used, and some of them are highly toxic. I mean, some of these are carcinogenic, and chemicals that, even at very low concentrations, are really dangerous. And so there's the injection of these into groundwater, and we really don't, into the ground, and people are concerned that they would reach groundwater. There haven't been cases where it's been confirmed that the fluids migrated from deep underground in these wells all the way up into groundwater, but the chemicals have been found in groundwater, and it's often hard to determine exactly how they got there. Really, there's a host of unknowns. We don't really understand well what happens with the fluids once they're underground. We don't even really understand the long-term effects of low doses, you know, exposure to low doses of these chemicals. But then, even apart from the actual fracturing process, it's sort of all the associative industrial practice that's involved, the trucking of all these fluids and chemicals to the site, and then just the drilling itself. You know, there's drilling creates a lot of air pollution. There's places out west where they've exceeded federal air standards sort of in the middle of nowhere, largely as a result of increased gas drilling.
Really? How does drilling create air pollution?
Well, there's the actual engines of the drilling rig and the pumps and compressors. You know, all these are big diesel engines that have a lot of emissions. But there's also the gas itself can leak out. Methane is the primary component of natural gas, and it's a potent greenhouse gas. And there's parts of the drilling process when this leaks out. But all the trucks, you know, drilling of an individual well can involve hundreds of truck trips to and from the well site.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Let's go back to the groundwater issue for just a moment. I mean, the wells that are being drilled, they're pretty deep. I mean, we're talking, what, a mile, mile and a half under the surface of the earth? The average aquifer is at most, what, several hundred feet? Most of the water that we bring up to the surface is at a pretty shallow depth. How do those two things compare?
That's right. Well, as I mentioned, there's the first thing that we really don't know what happens to the fluids deep underground, and we don't really understand very well the way these natural fractures interact underground and whether, you know, how far they go. But even beyond that, There's surface spills, which happen, have happened. There's blowouts, and once a blowout is when you're drilling a well, it's like what happened in the Gulf oil spill with BP. The fluids can spew out of the top of the well, and this happened in April in Pennsylvania, where thousands of gallons of fracturing fluid and brine spewed out of the well and spilled into a stream. But there's also the problem of well design. When you drill a well, it's surrounded with metal casing and cement that is supposed to protect aquifers. But that cement often fails. There's cracks or there wasn't a complete seal around it. And when that happens, gas and brine can leak up along the outside of the well and into groundwater. And this has happened a number of times around the country, and this is happening increasingly. That's what's happened in Dimock, Pennsylvania. If anyone's heard of that, it's a place where a number of water wells were contaminated with heavy metals and chemicals and methane gas. And that's exactly what happened in that case.
I don't want to make the discussion too esoteric, but what is the purpose of the chemicals? I mean, I can understand the uses of fluid to create hydraulic pressure and crack rock and so forth. What the chemical component in fracking serves what purpose exactly?
Well, it's really pretty amazing. I mean, each of the chemicals has a very specific purpose. You know, some chemicals reduce the friction, sort of make it slippery, so it takes less pumping to get the water down there. Some of the chemicals, they're biocides, sort of disinfectants to prevent any bacterial growth. There are chemicals that prevent the clay in the ground from coming out and interacting with the fluid, and there are also chemicals that then sort of counteract the reducing of friction and kind of gel up the liquid in order to set the sand in place. So it's this host of chemicals. Each one does a little thing to sort of tweak the fluid to exactly what the driller needs.
Okay, I get that. There are already some people who are calling in to join the program, and I want to invite others to do so. If you've got a question or a comment about fracking, this would be the hour to call. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Go to the Facebook fan page and leave a comment there. So, three ways for you to interact with the program this morning. 800-486-8655. We're talking about fracking, and we'll take some phone calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 21 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up after 1 today on Talk of the Nation. Opinion polls show that Americans are frustrated by both political parties. No better example than the fight over the debt ceiling as Republicans and Democrats play chicken with what could be an economic calamity. Frustrated enough to support a third party? Well, that's the question after 1 on Talk of the Nation. The mechanics, hurdles, purpose, and leadership of a viable third party. That's coming up later on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, as it's more commonly known. And my guest is Nick Kuznets, who is a freelance journalist, and he covers hydraulic fracturing for ProPublica. And he's with me on the phone, and so are a bunch of other people. But before we go to the phones, one more question about specifically about fracking. There's water and chemicals. Where does the water come from that is injected into these wells?
That depends on where you are in the country. There's a lot more water. There's more streams and rivers in the east as compared to out west, where water is much more of a scarce commodity. Out west, it can come more often from groundwater, but also from rivers and streams. And in the east, it's primarily surface water from lakes, from rivers, from streams. So, I mean, that has been another area of concern. It's less the overall volume of water that you're talking about. While it is huge, it's often small compared to other the water that the energy the power generation sector uses, or even that municipal houses and homes and businesses use. But when a lot of water is drawn from a stream at the wrong time, it can really cause a lot of harm. And so that's, an area of concern. It's caused problems in Pennsylvania, where water has been drawn from relatively low flow streams, reducing, the amount of water and harming life. But even the bigger issue is on the other side of waste, what you do with the water when it comes out of the well. And again, this has been something that has been a big problem for Pennsylvania, where the water, when it comes up, beyond the chemicals that are in there, it's highly salty, much saltier than seawater. And for a couple of years in Pennsylvania, this water was just discharged largely untreated into rivers and streams, creating problems with intakes for other industrial users along the streams. Their intake valves got clogged with heavy metals. A couple times, municipal water supplies even had to shut down temporarily because the water was too salty.
So the water comes back up. It doesn't stay down in the well. That gets drawn out along with the gas and oil, or how does it come back up?
A lot of the water does end up staying down in the well, actually, and it depends on the place. But in some cases, as much as 90% of the water is actually staying underground, the fate of which is largely unknown. But when you're talking about 6 million gallons per well, even 10% of that is a large volume if there's thousands of wells around a state.
Okay. I want to start with a Facebook comment from Nathaniel, and then we'll go to some phone calls. Nathaniel writes, "I believe one scientist who studied the process said something along the lines of, it is good because it produces less pollution than coal, but it needs to have good regulation because of the damage it could cause if done recklessly. Thus, this new form of getting energy is not a good place to try the least government is best theory." So says Nathaniel. What do you think? What do you have to say about that, Nick?
Well, one of the biggest questions about fracking over the last few years has been about to what extent the federal government is involved in regulation. The practice itself was given an exemption in 2005. The EPA regulates the what's called underground injection of fluids. So we do this with waste fluids. We do this to sort of help production of declining oil and gas wells. And the EPA regulates it when we inject fluids underground. But this practice was given an explicit exemption in 2005 with the Energy Policy Act. And, a lot of people, they're members of Congress who have been trying to remove that exemption because they feel that this is underground injection. It's, shooting fluids underground. And so why shouldn't it be regulated like other forms of that?
Okay. Here's a call from Gene in Wauwatosa. Whoops. I take that back. We're going to Beth. Okay, now we've got Gene in Wauwatosa. Here we go.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. There can't be enough information about this for people to realize how significantly damaging it is. And you really just covered my main question. Maybe let's direct it to who was pushing for that legislation that was exempted. And second, really, I guess there isn't a Superfund big enough to cover damage to people's health when they can light their tap water on fire?
Well, I'll address the first one first. It's known as the Halliburton loophole. And so it was largely, it was the oil and gas industry that was pushing for this exemption. Halliburton is, as some people may know, an oil services company. So it's one of the companies that does the actual fracking. When a an oil company or a gas company like Chesapeake drills a well, they'll usually hire a service company to come and do the fracturing. So it was those companies that were pushing for that exemption. And now the second half of the question, could you repeat that? Or
Gene, well, are you still there?
I'm concerned when you have presidential candidates calling for the disintegration of the EPA when you've got such an issue like this. And like I said, there can't be a Superfund big enough for the damages that this can cause to groundwater and drinking water, and without, you know, decent drinking water, people really are stuck.
Yeah, well, that's exactly people's concerns. The EPA is actually looking now exclusively at the question of how or to what extent or whether hydraulic fracturing can affect drinking water. There's a study that the EPA launched or announced earlier this year, and they're supposed to come out with their initial findings at the end of next year and then have a sort of final report by 2014, I believe the date is.
Gene, thanks for the call. Let's go to William in Colfax next. William, good morning.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the other end of it. Lately, there have been, I think, 38 existing or permitting or pending sand mines in western Wisconsin, and all this sand has been discovered to be the perfect sand for fracking. So it puts a huge number of trucks on our road every day, you know, burning diesel fuel, polluting the air, and causing, you know, a lot of heavy weight on the road and a lot more traffic in a rural area, and they're taking farmland out of production to dig up this sand. Yesterday I drove by a new sand mine that's just off of Highway 64, County Road Double D, just west of Bloomer, and it was a windy day yesterday, and there was literally a cloud of sand dust blowing. So, you know, silica dust is not a good thing to breathe. And then all these sand mines also are drilling high-capacity wells into the aquifer that feeds Eau Claire, Dunn County, Chippewa County, Barron County. This is like a resource that, you know, that's our drinking water. There's no life without water. And the other thing that I heard was that with this Energy Act that President Dick Cheney, who used to be the CEO of Halliburton, part of this bill, which this whole energy thing was in secret, that he made it so that people can't find out what the chemicals are that are being used, and I wondered if that was true or not. So, and this sand mining is really, it's an ugly thing to see. It really is.
Let's talk about the chemicals first, because that's something that's come up elsewhere in articles that you've written. It really is pretty tough to find out what these chemicals are that are being used in fracking.
Yeah, that's something I should have mentioned earlier. It's still not completely known what all the chemicals are. Again, because the federal government is not involved in regulating this, it's sort of left up to the states. And a number of states have passed laws that do disclose the chemicals, but there's proponents of full disclosure would say gaps in each of these laws, because in some cases the companies only have to disclose sort of their active ingredients, but even when they have to disclose everything, they're allowed to cite trade secrets and keep those secret. And there's often not a lot of oversight in terms of what is or isn't a trade secret. So it remains the case that companies can keep secret some of the chemicals that they inject into the wells and into the ground.
And at Willem's first point about sand mining, there's a specific kind of sand that works best for fracking. That's got to be dug up and transported. I think you mentioned just, you know, when we were talking about, well, where does the pollution come from? From this would be another example of something farther back up the stream, but certainly directly connected to fracking.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I haven't done a lot of reporting on the mining. I've read some about that mining in Wisconsin, but exactly. I mean, the drilling beyond the sort of immediate effects of drilling a well can have pretty profound impacts on, you know, communities that once were sort of quiet rural communities now have hundreds of truck trips going through and heavy machinery, compressor stations. You know, when the gas is taken out of the well, it needs to get pumped to pipelines to get sent off to cities. And along that process, it has to be compressed. So you have these big generators that compress that gas, and they make a lot of noise, and they create a lot of pollution.
Willem, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Milwaukee and hear what's on Joe's mind. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. You know, the European Union makes industry prove a practice won't adversely affect human health before they're given the go-ahead. Here, we have to prove it does before it's regulated. That's one point. The second point, if the price of this gas truly reflected the cost to the environment and human health, maybe we would use it accordingly.
All right, thanks, Joe. Nick?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I'm not as familiar with some of the laws in Europe, but there's one thing that, you know, you may be seeing of, for example, is that for chemicals, the burden is on the producer of a chemical to prove that it's safe, whereas in the U.S., really, the burden is on the government to prove that it's not safe. So, you know, this touches on, obviously, issues beyond oil and gas drilling, but you have tens of thousands of chemicals that are being used, and we really only have good information on, you know, maybe 1,000, maybe 1,200 of those chemicals, the rest of which are, at this point, just presumed safe, but there's really no information on them.
Let's go back to the regulation aspect. So the federal government is out of the regulatory picture as far as fracking is concerned, which leaves it to states and local units of governments to try to deal with this. Which states have been putting forth regulations, and how do those regulations compare? Are they fairly standard? Which states have the toughest rules, and which have the least restrictive?
Well, a few states have been updating their rules over the last few years. One of the most notable is Pennsylvania, where, you know, there's a long history of oil and gas drilling in Pennsylvania. The first commercial oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania, but when the drilling in the Marcellus Shale, which is the shale formation there that holds the gas, when that began really second half of the last decade, around 2006, 2007, the drilling suddenly just exploded at a rate that the state really wasn't prepared for. And so it kind of caught regulators off guard, but they responded by creating, you know, updating a number of their oil and gas regulations, a process that they're still doing. Just on Friday, the governor of Pennsylvania had commissioned a report from a panel to recommend a series of updates to the laws. And they go from the sort of small and arcane to larger ones like monitoring the health impacts, which at this point isn't done in the state. So Pennsylvania is one major state that's been doing that. Colorado updated their rules as well. And there's a different approach taken in New York where drilling, it's the same shale formation as in Pennsylvania. But in New York, they put drilling on hold and basically said, we want to, you know, make sure that we have our regulations in place and updated before any drilling goes on. And they're still in the process of updating those regulations.
New York City has some big concerns about their water supply, looking at proposed oil drilling there.
That's right, yeah. And in the latest draft version, the state regulators have been coming out with a series of drafts sort of proposing how to regulate it. And the at the beginning of this month, they released what should be the last draft before the final is produced. And in that version, they recommended prohibiting drilling in the New York City watershed. New York gets its water from reservoirs upstate in the Catskills and the Delaware River Basin. And the water is clean enough that it doesn't have to be filtered. So that presented sort of a unique situation for New York. And the city was really concerned that if there was drilling, you know, within that basin or even near that basin, that would harm the water. But for now, the proposal is that drilling wouldn't be allowed there.
Here's an email from Paul, who writes, I've read recently of a study or analysis that has found that companies have actually been cherry-picking the most productive but small areas within these much larger areas of predicted production. This means two things. One, yields on a large scale may be significantly smaller than current rosy projections. And two, wells outside of these small sweet spots are losers economically. Production drops off much sooner than expected, meaning that they will not be developed. What does your guest know about this?
Well, there was a story sort of on this topic by the New York Times recently that was basically saying that this shale gas promise of decades of production was I think there were the words Ponzi scheme were used, and there are a couple sort of serious concerns within that. One of the things reported was that they might be misreporting their reserves. This might be what the call is referring to. And, if they were misreporting their reserves, that would be a serious cause for concern. You know, they would essentially be saying that there's X amount of gas when there's half that in the area. Another issue is sort of, since a lot of these are relatively new wells, there's uncertainty about how long they'll produce. So, a gas well produces the most right when you drill it, and production sharply declines. But the companies are saying that these wells can produce for decades, 30 years maybe, whereas if the production declines over the next few years, it might be, a third of that.
All right, let's go next to Chris in Oshkosh.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with a lot of conservatives talk about this idea that studies show that there's so much oil right here in the United States that if, and I quote, Obama would just let them, they could drill enough oil that we wouldn't have to rely on OPEC. I don't know to what degree that's true. But what I suspect and fear is that when people hear this information, they make an assumption that if we would just drill, baby, drill, that we'd be talking about the oil suspended in the porous rock that you talked about, where you can use a more traditional drilling method, and that this fracking thing is something a little smaller and experimental. And then I'm curious, if we could drill all of the oil available in this country and be oil independent, what percentage of that would come from rock that had to be fracked?
Well, I can't give you an exact percentage, but there are a couple areas where there's new drilling for oil in shale, North Dakota and Texas in particular, that are quickly becoming very productive. North Dakota is now the fourth biggest oil and gas producing, oil producing state, whereas just a few years ago, it was a minor producer. But there's another issue in what you said, where this question of if only the government would let companies drill. Whereas if you look at the drilling trends, you see that drilling, especially oil drilling, has really skyrocketed over the last couple of years, despite any increased oversight by federal and state governments. So that argument kind of falls apart when you look at the fact that oil drillers are drilling in these areas and, they're not having too much trouble doing it.
Chris, thanks. Thanks for that call. There's room for you if you want to get in on this discussion at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email works, too. We've had some good emails this morning. talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. And that's another way to get your comment on the air. So three ways to get a hold of us. Take advantage of one of them right now as we enter the last third of the program. 800-486-8655. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about fracking this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 942, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, we'll talk about the universe, the wonders of the universe. It's a new book by Brian Cox. And also there's a companion BBC television series. We'll be talking about that and all of the endless wonder and questions that have consumed mankind throughout the eons here as we think about our universe and what it means. Well, we'll talk about the wonders of the universe after 10 o'clock. This hour, we're talking about the practice of hydraulic fracturing, high-volume hydraulic fracturing. The shorthand for that is fracking. It is a controversial practice, very productive in terms of what it's able to do on the extraction side of getting more oil and natural gas up to the surface where we can use it. On the other hand, there are some risks attached, and we've been talking about that this hour with Nicholas Kuznets, reporting fellow covering hydraulic fracturing for ProPublica. More callers, and let's start with John in Milwaukee.
Hi, John, good morning. I just wanted to bring up a point from a question from the last caller. He was talking about drill, baby, drill, and allowing the U.S. to produce enough so that we could stop importing oil. And the statistic that I've read, and I've read it in several places, I don't know if your guests can verify it or not, but from what I have read, the United States actually consumes about three times the amount of oil that we produce. So we would have to triple the present-day oil production to be able to get to a point where we actually produce the same amount of oil that we consume on a daily basis. So I thought that was something that your listeners might want to contemplate, that we actually consume three times as much oil as we produce. So there would have to be a lot more oil production for us to get to that point where we can make the two equal.
Yeah, you know, I don't have an exact number. I can't confirm that stat, but if my memory serves me, I think it's not quite that high. Maybe closer to half or so. But I think this point still stands that we consume a lot more oil than we do, and we're not necessarily going to, close that gap just by drilling more oil. But one other point on the question of is there enough out there? These new production areas in North Dakota and Texas where they're drilling oil from shale. Also, you know, there's tar sands, which is another form of getting oil from formations that previously wasn't economical. That's being done a lot in Canada. More oil is found with new technology, but it's sort of a question of at what cost. Both of these practices use a lot more water than traditional oil drilling and have greater consequences on the environment, greater pollution. So it's more a question of at what cost.
John, thanks for the call. George in Superior, you're next. George, good morning.
Good morning. A couple of things, unless I miss them in the conversation. The formations that are being drilled are more or less horizontal in most areas, and when we drill down, we have new technology, we drill horizontally. And so you picture a well in one area, but it's actually like a spider web going out up to miles in each direction that creates a much bigger impact than if it was just a point source. In addition, these formations can undulate, and local topography can cut them, and so they might not be restricted to thousands of feet below the surface. And so I just wanted to point out that the impact could be much greater than just a single point area.
Yeah, that's true. And the last point you make about the sort of complex geology, in New York, for example, where we talked about, they've held off on drilling, one of the issues has been how close will drilling be allowed to the pipes that take water from the reservoirs to New York City. The city asked for, in a previous round, they asked for a 7-mile buffer zone. So far, the state is saying that drilling can happen much closer than that, even within 1,000 feet, if special provisions are met. But in in those comments, when the city asked for that difference, they cited exactly what you're talking about. They said, you know, the formation comes up much higher in that area, and that there are cracks and natural fissures that can extend for miles, and that we really don't know and can't say for sure that fluids and gas can't travel through those cracks.
George, thanks for the call. Joanne in Door County, you're next. Joanne, good morning. Hello, Joanne. I think we lost her. Here's an email from Phil in Mount Horeb. The big energy lock on the American energy scene, both economically and politically, is outrageous. It is patently, fundamentally a flaw to allow the involved companies to write the rules and the legislation, and for people whose election campaigns are funded by those companies to set the national direction. Both fracking and shale oil development are prime examples of this egregious trust, which we borrow from future generations. Quarterly profit margin whims are not compatible with national long-term strategies. We need an Apollo-type program to mobilize a massive technological, legal, commercial shift to non-nuclear renewable energy systems. Sadly, in a democracy which elects representatives who are beholden to corporations, we have set in motion a disastrous course.
Well, I mean,
strong words.
Sorry, go ahead.
Strong words from Phil in Mount Horeb.
Strong words indeed, and I think there's no doubt that the oil and gas industry is very powerful politically, and has been able to get certain breaks and exemptions their way.
All right, let's see. Let's try Connie in Caledonia, Minnesota. Minnesota, Connie, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, I live near a rock quarry, and I was wondering if they have the same, type of use to crack the rock as for oil and gas.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how exactly they crack rock at rock quarries.
I think traditionally it's been done with explosives, but and drilling. But I'm not an expert on that either. I wouldn't even want to speculate, although I just did. I guess, Connie, we don't have a good answer for you. That might be something we could look into. In the meantime, here's an email from Tom in Wisconsin Rapids. He asks, is it true that New Jersey's legislature has recently voted to ban fracking there?
It is true. I'm not sure whether the governor has acted on that yet. I'll have to check that. But it is true that the legislature did enact a ban. But it's largely symbolic because there isn't any drilling really going on in New Jersey, and there isn't any that I know of planned. So it was a largely symbolic act on their part.
And then, that was the first question, and then he went on to say fracking is reaching Wisconsin in a huge way, and he refers actually to an earlier caller that we had from Colfax, who says as the pollution caused by sand mining to support fracking in small farming communities in Wisconsin is alarming. Silicosis is directly related to sand mining. Farmers are being bought out with exorbitant land prices, leaving their lands in ruin for future generations. What will this land be like for future generations? So some big concerns there from Tom in Wisconsin Rapids. Let's go to the phones again. We'll take a call next from Ron in Toma.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest said his comment was at what cost. Maybe this will reflect a little on cost. Does he have a brother or sister or a mother or father in Afghanistan or Iraq? And the billions of dollars that we spend overseas to protect oil assets, wouldn't that money be better spent in the United States? And less loss of human life? I'll take his comments off the air.
I don't have any family in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's a valid point, but I think a question again is sort of how much oil is there in the U.S. and is pure drilling enough to close the gap that an earlier caller had referred to?
Well, the bigger question is the overall energy policy. and perhaps, you know, that can't even be discussed rationally just in the context of any one country, because we live on a planet and we're all on it and we don't really have any way off. Perhaps what we need is energy policy discussions at the global level to see what the way forward is, because certainly we've seen a much greater energy usage in other parts of the world. Meanwhile, here in the United States, our own appetite for hydrocarbons remains voracious. And we all should probably take responsibility for that. But, you know, it seems that the discussion needs to be about more than just fracking, if I'm reading what Ron and Toma and what others have said here this morning about their concerns.
Yeah, I think these are definitely exactly. These are larger sort of energy policy questions, not just about sort of, you know, how we do it, but, you know, whether we do it and to what extent we do it.
Don in Wanakee, you're next. Don, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for the program today. We are fortunate enough, my wife is fortunate enough to have three oil wells in northwestern North Dakota. And we're from North Dakota originally. I've been following the fracking issue. And from what I understand in North Dakota with the depth that they go and then the cement casing that when they go through groundwater, the cement casing there, also there's actually no reports of any wells being contaminated. They ask people, farmers, to do a baseline study of their wells and then yearly check. As of the last report, there has been no reports of groundwater contamination. Plus 12,000 jobs, budget surplus, and so I think there has to be a balance there. Also, when I was in Minot, I saw big bags of sand from Russia. We imported from Russia. Now, there has to be a way for us to supply that sand economically and environmentally safe instead of importing from Russia. Thanks, and I'll take your comment.
Yeah, Don, thanks. Thanks for the call. Well, you know, there are a lot of jobs tied to this, and Don's point is, where's the proof that there's any harm?
Well, you know, he brought up North Dakota, and there are a lot of jobs, and North Dakota has it might be the lowest unemployment in the country. It's certainly among them, and the oil drilling has been a big part of that. And you know, I have done less work in North Dakota. I do know there have been some major spills there, but there's certainly been huge benefits to the local economy there. I mean, you can't argue against that.
Well, what about his point that that they are doing testing of wells, and they do the baseline, and they do what they can to protect the aquifer? I mean, at some point we have to say, okay, there's a certain amount of risk that we're willing to accept because we need to have this energy. We keep turning on computers and televisions and light bulbs and refrigerators and driving automobiles. As a society, do we have to say, well, you know what, there's a certain amount of risk we're willing to take, and that's that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, any energy source has its own risks, and so it's a matter of sort of, you know, gauging those risks and then making sure that, you know, what we do is being done safely.
Let's try to sneak in one more call here. David in Watertown, you'll have to be brief because we're almost out of time.
Good morning. I just wanted to recommend a documentary I viewed recently. It's entitled Gasland. It's made by a native New Yorker who follows this story nationwide. It's fascinating. I got it through my library, so you might be able to get a hold of it. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, David. Nick, are you familiar with that documentary?
Yeah, I am familiar with the documentary. I mean, it got you know, a lot of press, and it drew a lot of attention to the issue over the last, you know, couple of years.
We're in the last minute of the program here, so I want to wrap things up. What is, in your view, the future of fracking? Are we likely to see any federal regulation, given that Congress can't even agree on raising the debt ceiling? Are states where the action is?
Certainly for now, states are where the action is. And, you know, some states have been sort of more active in changing rules than others, but I think any federal changes, you know, if they do come, aren't coming anytime too soon.
And in the meantime, we still have the greater debate about energy policy, not just in the United States, but around the world to consider as well. It's a pretty complex problem, and I appreciate your spending some time with us this morning to help illustrate one part of it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking about fracking with Nicholas Kuznets, reporting fellow covering hydraulic fracturing for ProPublica. If you missed part of the program, want to go back and hear it all over again, you can do that later today by going to WPR.org, going to the Kathleen Dunn section, and you should be able to listen to the program online. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming and handled on-air production as well. Coming up, The Wonders of the Universe, a new book by Brian Cox. Should be a fun discussion coming up after the news. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.